All right, so are you covenanted? Part six. Yes. Okay, so today we're going to go into this part six, and as we do so, we actually are going to cover a section that we probably could have chronologically done last time, but I moved it to now because it actually has a part of it that goes very well as a lead into what your children are going to be studying in the Beatitudes classes that they're looking at right now with this program all week long with the YMTY program. Because there is a part of this deal with covenant that actually ends up in Matthew chapter 5. So this is kind of a side piece that I put in here that I moved because I thought timing-wise it would be great to do it as in conjunction with what the children are studying. So again, as a reminder, we're looking at covenants, not just the covenant, but all covenants to a certain degree. And we're seeing how the covenant plays into this, and the covenant being the one that we saw at Sinai, Exodus 19. And so we've been studying this a lot. We've seen some covenants between people and individuals with Yahweh, and we've seen the ones that he's made with all people, or the ones he's made with the whole earth, the idea of the rainbow as a sign that he would not destroy the earth. Let's remember that a covenant is an agreement, a formal one, usually between two or more people, to do or not do something specified. Okay, so it's about performing or not performing, doing something or not doing something as agreed. So really, it's like a contract. If I hire you to fix my kitchen sink because it's busted, then we have a covenant that has a very specified thing. I agree that I will be giving you money, and you agree that you will be fixing my sink. Okay, so that's so it's like a covenant. It's a type of contract, where there's a specified understanding of performance of something, a doing or not doing as agreed. Okay? We've also talked about quite a bit that there were consequences when done between human beings and our Creator, and when the human beings fall apart on their side of it. Not a whole lot of concern about Yahweh falling apart on it, because he wouldn't. Okay? He keeps all of his side of everything. It's us that falls apart and messes up and doesn't keep our covenant. And so we talked quite a bit last time about consequences. So today, as we go through this, I want to begin in Numbers chapter 25. Numbers 25 and in verse 10. And Yahweh spoke to Moshe, saying, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aharon the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel because he was ardent with my ardor in their midst, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my ardor. This is almost a better word or understanding, like when it says jealous. Okay, that ardor that he has. Now remember what happened before this is that we see in the earlier part of the chapter that while Israel was dwelling in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab, and so then the people had invited them to do the slaughterings to their mighty ones, and all this mess was going on, and then Pinchas finally stood up, and he took his spear and he said, enough of this. And so now because of that, Yahweh spoke to Moses to talk about what he was going to do with Pinchas. He says, therefore, verse 12, because Pinchas was willing to step up and turn back my wrath and have that ardor in the midst of all of this craziness, he says, therefore say, see, I am giving him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and to his seed after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was ardent for his Elohim and made atonement for the children of Israel. I'm going to stop right there. So what we have here is two things that have been a part of what we're talking about. One we've talked about quite a little bit is that sometimes he makes a covenant that's not for you. This one was for Pinchas and his descendants specifically. This is not about all of us, but it's a covenant. It says so right there. I read it. You read it. But also it says it's an everlasting covenant. A covenant of and it shall be to him and to his seed after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Okay, so does Pinchas have a priesthood going right now? No? I'm not disagreeing with you, by the way. Some of you are like, yes? No? Help me, Rabbi, what's the right answer? Okay. And so we have to understand that everlasting or forever is not what you think it is. And I have a teaching that I might do, and I keep telling you I might do at some point. It's a really short teaching called How Long is Forever? Because scripturally, forever is not what you think it is. Often it is understood as for as long as specific things are in place. So if there were to be a Levitical priesthood, guess whose descendants would be high priest? Pinchas. That's the promise here. No priesthood, not breaking of any of this. But if we have, this would be. So as long as there was, it was a descendant of Pinchas. Does that make sense? Do we follow that? So let's understand when you see this word forever, because some of you say, when you talk about the Torah and different stuff, oh, they say to your friends, well, what, do you got a problem with forever? Well, actually, forever is not exactly forever. It depends. Now, Torah, it says, well, if you look up and see the sun and the moon and the stars, it's still valid. So I think we can still see that it's still valid. So there are certain parameters that you can check. So just understand that what's not clear here, but if you read through, especially because now we can look backwards and see how it played out. Back then, this is the beginning of it. But we can now look back and say, wait a minute, that priesthood came to an end at some point when there was no more priests. So wait a minute, Yahweh failed because he promised him that he had an everlasting priesthood as a covenant. Yes, that it would be Pinchas. So it's, again, Hebrew into English doesn't give you all the fullness of the nuances of what was going on then. So let's just understand that, number one, not all covenants, again, we can see are for us. This one was for Pinchas and his descendants. But also, covenants are for as long as certain things are in place. So the covenant that Israel broke now needs to have a new covenant or a renewal of that covenant, because the new one's not going to be any different than the old one, except that this time Israel is going to keep it. And that's what you read in Jeremiah 31:31. So let's understand that that's what it's talking about. Now, some of you are going to ask me what this covenant of peace is. I don't know. We can guess. We're not going to spend a lot of time on that today. Okay? But he says, I'm going to give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and to his seed after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Okay? So whatever it was, he gave it to Pinchas. So again, let's not overstress on things he didn't give to you. Because sometimes people will call me up about things. I'm like, why is this an issue for you? There's so many things that you're still struggling with that are issues for you. So why are you struggling with this thing that will never affect you in your life? But I need to know. Don't get all Gnostic on me. That addiction to needing, to thinking you're somehow special only because you validate yourself through information. Oh, I know, which makes me special. I know, which gives me security. I know. Knowing and having information is not all it's cracked up to be. Remember, we talked about it being more relational, and the information is to help you with the relationship. And some of the things in the information in this book, if you could figure out all the sacrifices and how they worked and everything about the temple, you would understand some things that could help you with the relationship, but most of it is stuff you wouldn't be doing today. There's no temple. So it would be a great deep study to do, and I'm not against it. Lots of teachers teach it, and that's great. But some of you still are struggling with what you're eating. We're struggling with like how to keep feasts and Sabbaths and tithing and all the basic stuff, with getting your eyes in your head and all your thoughts right with adultery and those kind of things, or murder. And we got enough things to work on that are much more immediate and clear. So I'm not against the other stuff. Don't misquote me. I get that anyway all the time, so it doesn't matter, but don't misquote me. That stuff can be interesting and can be useful. You can learn a lot about the implied and hinted at stuff in there. But you know what? If I'm a kid and I'm trying to learn how to walk, understanding about how cars work isn't important, or how to shift a gear shift so that I'm in drive or in park or whatever it is. I'm still trying to figure out how to get my feet moving. Okay, as a matter of fact, let's take it even back further. Do you remember looking at babies and they're like, all of a sudden they realize, oh, that's mine. How do I make that work? Do I have control over that thing? But that's kind of what you are as a newborn in this, to some degree. Okay, you're starting to realize that you have control over things you never realized you had control over, and you realize you don't have control over things you thought you did have control over. Let me say that slower. You are coming to realize that there's an awful lot of things that you should have control over that you don't, a lot of things that you have tight control over that you shouldn't. And so why don't we focus on those things more? That's what this ministry tries to do. If we ever can get all of that basic stuff really rocking and rolling, maybe we'll have time then to study this other stuff. And I'm not against you doing it, but if you're studying it, meaning all this other stuff, more than the everyday walk stuff, you're focusing your attention too much in the wrong direction. You're out of balance. Okay, you're out of balance. So let's make sure that you're not out of balance. Okay? Now, So we have this section here. And so this section is to show us a key piece, which is that when it says that a covenant is forever, and people will say, well, it's not happening now, so the book lied. You can help them understand that forever, as expressed in Scripture, means for as long as certain things exist. And this is really important, because if those things don't exist, then that whole forever thing is... You know that the smoke from the Sodom and Gomorrah went up forever? Well, as long as until the fire finally gave out. And in other words, it wasn't going to be put out. It was going to finish its job. And then when it did, we don't still see it burning. If you go by the land and you get to where Sodom and Gomorrah was, you'll still see fire burning. When it finished, it finished. Okay? So hopefully that makes some sense on that little piece there for how long is forever. Actually, that was the whole little mini teaching right there without using a lot of extra verses. Because I could have shown you other places where it said things were forever, but clearly it wasn't the way you think of it, meaning like never stopping, perfect all the time, always there. It means until it finishes and accomplishes everything it was meant to do. Like we can understand with many things, or until the parameters are somehow not available to do it. Hopefully I beat that to death. We're ready to move on. Okay. Leviticus chapter 2. This is where we're going backwards. I said we were going to maybe cover something that was skipped. And we'd already been further on in Leviticus, but let's go to chapter 2. And in verse 13, now this is where we're talking about offerings. And in talking about offerings, there are all kinds of things. I mean, I'll tell you what, you want to read the first couple of chapters of Leviticus. When we get to that Torah portion, and it talks about all these different offerings, the whole burnt offering and the meal offering and the drink offering and all this other stuff. And you'll be sitting there going, what? What does this have to do with me? And you'd be right to struggle with that. But there are some things buried in here, like I'm going to point out now, that are connected to covenant. In verse 13, it says in chapter 2, and season with salt every offering of your grain offering, and do not allow the salt of the covenant of your Elohim to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you bring salt. And that thing just stands there. It's like a single verse. I'm like, what? What covenant and what salt and what's the salt of the covenant of your Elohim? And then it never says another word about it for chapters upon chapters upon chapters. Like, what? What's a salt covenant related thing? If you go to Numbers chapter 18, it pops up again. And in verse 19, it says, all the contributions of the set apart gifts which the children of Israel present to Yahweh, I have given to you and your sons and daughters as with you as a law forever. Well, there it is again. Well, for as long as the offerings are being given and there's a temple, they belong to whoever it is he's talking about here. We know that in the chapter 18, the beginning, it's Aaron and his sons. So it's to his family that get these things. But listen to what it says after. It says, I've given to you and your sons as a law forever. It is a covenant of salt forever. Okay, we have a covenant with the world. Now, I'm not going to destroy it again with a flood and there's a rainbow. I got a covenant at Sinai. Of course, you know, we could say we have the Adamic covenant, the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant. We talked about some of these things. A covenant with salt? What? Everybody's told us all these years it's bad for you. It's going to give you a heart attack. Lay off the salt. Now he's telling you to salt all the bread. Make sure there's all the salt is on there. And he said, I got a covenant of salt. What's the deal with the salt? Okay, so he says here, it is a covenant of salt forever before Yahweh with you and with your seed, and your seed who's with you. Okay, so let's understand this covenant of salt thing. See, part of this is going to be a really good lesson for those of you who think that you know your Bibles to realize there's some very big challenges in whether you can really understand everything in your Bible. One of them is cultural. Okay, you are going to have a real hard time as anybody just anywhere living in 2018 compared to the fact that this was written several thousand years ago. So culturally, that's going to be different. I mean, you can look at it. Look, we're here in North Carolina. We're in the United States. Just look at what things were like just 50 years ago, or let's say 100 years ago, just in this country. We're not going back thousands of years. Okay, this is 2018. What if we went back to 1918 or 1818 or 1718? Does things change dramatically? That's only a few hundred years. And so this is several thousand years ago. Can we also understand that when we have generations talking to each other, they sometimes don't really meet, you know, because culturally, some things that are acceptable now weren't acceptable then and vice versa? I couldn't explain to my grandmother when I was, I don't know, 20 or around 20, 21, and I was a DJ at the time, and I was DJing a party for one of my cousins, and my grandmother was trying to fix me up with a bunch of 15-year-olds because after all, that was, you know, by the time you got to 18 or 20, in her generation, you were an old maid. And I said, Grandma, no. Because she didn't see the problem. Because if you go back generationally, that wasn't as much a problem. Okay? And I don't remember how old they were, but they were younger than I had any interest in. But that was the point, was in her, to her mind, that was not a problem. Because in some cultures, if you're still not married and you're 18 or 20, you're old. You're like an old maiden and nobody's ever going to marry you. But that was a cultural thing. And so let's understand how that kind of works out. Do you remember there was a cultural thing that Jacob ran into? Oh, you can't marry the younger sister without the older sister getting married first. That's not a Torah command. But that was a cultural thing. And so here we're seeing also that this salt thing, which we don't understand, turns out it's a cultural thing. So let's understand that the covenant of salt, we do this in wedding ceremonies. Okay, I use this often as part of wedding ceremonies. Okay, as a symbol of the covenant that people make when they come together for a marriage, for example, the bride and the groom can each bring with them salt in a container, in a bag, whatever they bring. And often for a wedding, they'll bring a glass container that they can leave in a nice, pretty place so they can remind themselves of what they're about to do with this covenant of salt ceremony. And the salt that they bring, they understand it's been used in covenants forever as a symbol of forever. In other words, because salt really lasts like forever. It's not, you don't destroy it. It doesn't go bad. It's salt. Salt has been used in preservation and cannot be destroyed. They bring these in a marriage ceremony, they bring their salt as a symbol that their covenant that the bride and the groom have just made also will be preserved and cannot be destroyed. Isn't that a powerful symbol? Because in the ancient Near East, this is the way contracts were done, okay? In the eyes of Yahweh, every believer like salt is priceless in his sight in ancient times. When two people wanted to enter a covenant of loyalty, they would recite the details of the covenant, exchange salt from one pouch to the other, and then shake the pouches. The symbolism is powerful. The only way their contract could possibly be broken is for each to individually retrieve their own grains of salt, which would be impossible. Although I've had a few brides and grooms try to use different colored salt. But it'll look so pretty in our glass jar. He comes with blue salt, she comes with pink salt, and then kind of mix them together. Look, it's not sand art. It's a salt covenant, okay? Because that's what they act like. Oh, put a little more, put a little more. And they're like, oh, so what are you doing, a sand art project, or are you getting married? Okay, and I'm reading, if this is actually literally what I read at a wedding ceremony. So that's why I was reading it off the paper. This is right out of what I use in a wedding ceremony. The only difference is, instead of saying bride and groom, I would say the name of the bride and the groom having come together and what they're going to do in the ceremony. So here, because this book is written in real time, in real people's lives, in a real cultural situation where there were things that were done, we have to remember that when you read scripture, there's going to be things you will not understand or not understand correctly. One of the two. Either you won't understand it or you won't understand it correctly because you weren't there. You're here now. You're disconnected from the time and the culture, so you don't understand the idiomatic phrases. You don't understand some of the things that are being described that were very understood well by the, you know, understood very well by the people then. Like this idea of a covenant of salt. So Yahweh throws it in and says, look, just like you guys do with a covenant of salt, this is a covenant you have with me. Once you covenant with me, you can't separate the salt. You can't pull that out of the pouch and separate this out. It's forever. You've made a lifetime commitment. And so he wants the salt to be on the offerings to remind us of our covenant of salt. And so here, this should also help you understand that when we do Kiddush and Hamotzi, Kiddush and Hamotzi, which are our blessings before the meal, which we often have after services, and so we have the wine and we have the bread. If you are ever doing it in a more Christianized sort of place that's trying to pick up on Jewish stuff, there probably won't be any salt. But if you have people there that understand the Jewish cultural nature of the ceremony of Kiddush and Motzi, and it is a Jewish ceremony, not a Catholic one, in case you wondered. And communion has nothing to do with what the Jews do. Has nothing to do with Kiddush and Motzi. And so there will always often be a salt shaker so that when you tear off the bread, you can put a little bit of salt to remind you of your covenant of salt. Also, because it's an offering in a sense of bread, we're not sacrificing and doing offerings in the temple, but we are doing a blessing and a prayer, and we have bread. He says, always make sure your bread has salt when you're doing it in that context. And so hopefully now you understand why. Now, don't get mad at us if we don't have salt all the time, because it's not a Torah command now that whenever you eat bread, you got to put salt on it. If there was a temple and we were making these offerings, it would have salt, as he says. Okay, these offerings. Now, let's go to Matthew chapter 5. Now, for some of you that are confused because I talked about communion and all this other stuff, one of the things that happens when we do our little Kiddush and Motzi before eating a meal is we have to remind people that what we're not doing as opposed to what we're doing. What we're not doing is communion. You know, Yeshua sat down and had supper with his disciples, and he did what they always did. They took up a cup of wine and blessed. They had bread and they blessed. But he chose, as he often did, to use it as a teaching moment to give them a memory trigger. So the memory trigger was, wine looks like blood. When you have wine, think of me. Think of my blood that I've shed for you. Not make a new ceremony. They were doing this for years before Yeshua ever came in the flesh. It wasn't a new thing. See, that's the thing. You come as Christians into this, you think, oh, look at what Yeshua did, this new thing. And a Jew's thinking, we've been doing this for 100 years before he ever did that. And that's why he did it, by the way, because he was a Jew in a Jewish community having a meal. And guess what they almost always had at their meals? Wine and bread. It was very much a staple of the diet. And so he says, look, I'm the bread of life. So you're eating bread? Think of me. It's a memory trigger. And so these are things that would cause us to think about him and remember him and have that be more present in our thoughts when we do the things that we do. Okay? Because I know people get very confused, because that's, by the way, what happens when a Gentile teaches you Torah or a Gentile teaches you Jewish culture. And most of the Hebrew roots congregations are taught by Gentiles. I'm not picking on that, but you know what? If you have a Jew teaching you, the Jew would understand more than you would understand, because at least as a Jew, some of that culture has been passed down. Not because they're smarter, but because if you were German, Spanish, if you were Mexican, if you were from New Zealand or Australia or Austria and Sweden, all these countries, there are things that you would know if you grew up there the whole time that somebody wouldn't know if they just moved there. There are cultural things that go back generations that you would understand because you have that. But of course, what if you went to a place that taught that understanding and had no cultural background? They didn't even understand what was going on. And they're going to use a book written thousands of years ago about those ceremonies and things, and they're going to try to tell you what that means? How are they going to know? How are they going to understand? And so we need more Abba to call, more Jews, so that he could have them to help us understand. What is it? What is that? That Yeshua was doing, talking to a Jewish community as a Jew and using language they would understand. Using language they would understand. You know, in Matthew chapter 5, in verse 17, it says, do not think that I came to destroy the Torah of the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to complete. Do you know that I've done some research, others have done research, is likely a Jewish idiomatic phrase that was said before midrashing. You know what midrashing is? Taking Torah, discussing it, breaking it down, trying to understand what the Torah is talking about. And it was traditional understanding was that when a person did this, if they did it well, they were thought of as having completed it. And if they did it badly, they destroyed it. Now, would you know that? How would you know that? Well, as a Jew, you might know that. Certainly as a Jew back then, you would have known that. Because you know what he does right after he says these words? What does he do? He midrashes. He says, you know, of old it says this. Let me tell you what that really means. And you know, of old it says not to do that. Well, let me tell you what that really means. He says, I'm coming here to give you the true interpretation, the true Midrash. And I'm going to complete, not destroy, because it's going to be the right one. It's going to be the good one. Well, that's a different understanding about chapter 5, verse 17, isn't it? But did you even consider all that? Now, how could you? You don't have the background for it. That doesn't make you less. It's no offense. It's no insult. Most Jews wouldn't know what that phrase is today. You'd have to go back and research and say, what was that phrase like being used back in the day? First of all, you'd have to revert this back into Hebrew. So what would that idiomatic phrase sound like? Then you'd have to go to some research and say, was there ever a phrase like this being used at this time? And so it's very interesting. So now we're going to get into chapter 5, verse 1. But when he saw the crowds, he went up on a mountain. And when he was seated, his taught ones came to him. And having opened his mouth, he was teaching them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, because theirs is the reign of the heavens. Blessed are those who mourn, because they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, because they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, because they shall be filled. Blessed are those are the compassionate, because they shall obtain compassion. Blessed are the clean in heart, because they shall see Elohim. Blessed are the peacemakers, because they shall be called sons of Elohim. Blessed are those persecuted for righteousness' sake, because theirs is the reign of the heavens. Blessed are you when they reproach and persecute you, and falsely say every wicked word against you for my sake. Rejoice and be glad, because your reward in the heavens is great. For in this way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes tasteless, how shall it be seasoned? For it is no longer of any use, but to be thrown out and to be trodden down by men. Now, the reason I read the Beatitudes instead of just starting here with verse 13, because sometimes we get distracted by the single verse teaching method that you've heard most of your life. They pull one verse out and make a whole teaching verse thing. And so you would maybe miss that the you at the beginning of that verse, the you are, who are the you are? The ones that fall into the blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek. Those are the you, not everybody. These ones. Can we agree? Follow the flow. Blessed are those. And he says, you are the salt of the earth. Which you? You who are fit under all of that mess. All of that clean, I shouldn't say mess, all of that good stuff. The blessed are. You are the salt of the earth. Because see, if you're not of the blessed are, you are the ones that have lost their seasoning and are no longer of any use, but are thrown out. Does it make sense? We're following that? So when you read this verse, oh, we could all quote, you are the salt of the earth. I bet you most of you couldn't remember where it came from, and most of you wouldn't know it was connected to the Beatitudes. But it clearly flows into that. And so let's understand how that fits then back into the salt covenant. All of those starting in verse 3, blessed are, don't those sound like covenanted people? Those who have made the change in them to come in line with him. Do you hear that word, blessed are? That's when your salt has its savor still. He says, but if you are not covenanted, then you're like the salt that's lost its seasoning. It's not; it doesn't flavor anything. It's useless. And so it gets trodden down by men. It gets thrown out. You are the light of the world. Everybody? Or the guys who have the blessed are? The blessed are, right? So see how this plays through. See how there's a connection between these things. And it has to do with covenant. Now notice that it says, you are the light of the world. It is impossible for a city to be hidden on the mountain, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it shines to all those in the house. Let your light so shine before men so that they see your good works and praise your Father who is in the heavens. That's covenant language right there, isn't it? Because what is it that he offered them? He offered them to be his people up on the hill, shining that light. Because I saw that, wait a minute, light of the world, up on the hill. That's what he offered them in the covenant. So you see how this plays through. So you may want to say, as a covenanted person, I may need to go back and look at Matthew chapter 5 and figure out, am I poor in spirit? Am I mourning? Am I meek? Am I hungry and thirsty for righteousness? Am I compassionate? Am I clean in heart, etc.? Because those are characteristics of those in covenant. If you don't have those characteristics, then you're doing the covenant mechanically. This is like going to Galatians and reading the fruit of the Spirit. Because can we all agree that you can mechanically keep the Torah and still not manifest love, joy, peace, patience, etc.? Can we agree? So with that being said, the same thing is the case here. And I love the way that it starts with, blessed are the poor in spirit. My wife was encouraging me to actually do a whole teaching just on the Beatitudes. Anybody want one of those? Yeah. Okay. So we'll start that right now. No, I'm kidding. Okay. So Are You Covenanted Part 6 is also Beatitudes Part 1. No, I'm kidding about that. But let's just look at verse 3 for a second that leads into all this. It all starts with this. Blessed are the poor in spirit because theirs is of the reign of heaven. So what does it mean to be poor in spirit? What did we teach that spirit means? When you see the word spirit, what are we talking about? Intrinsic nature. See, I got my sort of students here hoping to get smiley face stickers at the end of this. I left them back in the room. Sorry. Okay. It means intrinsic nature. So what this is saying indirectly is blessed are those who are poor in their own intrinsic nature so that they can then be infilled with his intrinsic nature. Because the question has to be asked. It says, those who are poor in spirit, theirs is the reign of the heavens. Well, why? Right? Why do they get the reign of the heavens? Because you, with your spirit, are not qualified for that. You would wreck it, destroy it, kind of like we're doing right now. Why would we do to that any different than we're doing to this? There'd be no difference. And so we have to become poor in spirit. And most of us are very strong-willed, strong spirit in that spirit and man thing. And we haven't really gotten ourselves to kind of make ourselves poor in spirit. And so when we're covenanted, the covenant is what? If you would obey, I will take you and take care of everything, take you as my people, etc. Well, I don't think we can really obey if we're not poor in spirit. Because the me, I, which sounds like, well, I don't like that. Well, why do I have to do that? Do I really have to do all of that? Well, that's what HaSatan said. Well, this is really what Yahweh said. Because some of you call me up, and I have to ask the question after you ask me the question. Do you really not know the answer, or is you just hoping for a different answer? Because somebody will call me up about Sabbath keeping, or about tithing, or about food, or about whatever it is. And I know they know. And I'm like, really? Do you not know, or you know, but you're just not ready to do? Which is it? And then they're like, because they're not poor enough yet in spirit. Our spirit is striving against his spirit. Stop striving, get out of the way. Not really complicated. Stop striving, get out of the way. Let him drive. Okay, so that's what that's going on. See how that would then be a part of covenant. In covenant, he's not just expecting us to mechanically just obey. He's also expecting us to transform. He's expecting us to become a certain type of person, that type being the type of person he wants to spend forever with. And that person's going to be poor in spirit and mourn over things and be comforted. By the way, do you notice the mourning and comfort thing comes right after the poor in spirit? Doesn't it sound like, anybody know what that sounds like? What'd you say? James, exactly. Okay, so if you look at James, it's the same exact thing. Good job. You've heard me say this many times. Okay, so in James chapter 4, it says, verse 8, draw near to Elohim and he shall draw near to you. That sounds like covenant language. Cleanse hands, sinners, and cleanse your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to dejection. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Master and he shall lift you up. Did you notice that what it said? It said, let your joy, let the things that you love and me, but I like and I want. He says, you're going to have to get over it. Let it go. Guess what? Some of that stuff you really, really loved. You really liked it. You enjoyed it. You hate giving it up. Fine, he says, get it out of your system, cry about it, moan about it, mourn about it, and then humble yourself so he can lift you up. Isn't that the same thing that he's rephrased from Matthew 5? He says, you got to become poor in spirit, mourn and get over it so he can comfort you. This is James giving his sort of way of expressing what Yeshua said in Matthew 5. That's what I believe. He's just rephrasing it so that you can understand how to apply what's going on in these two verses. So he took a couple of verses to say what Yeshua said. If you would be poor in spirit, if you would humble yourself, what's it take? Well, blessed are those who mourn because they shall be comforted. There's nothing wrong with the fact that you liked and enjoyed and missed things. But if you still hold on to that and you still regret it and you're still mad about it, guess what you're probably going to do at some point? Still go back and do it. Or you're not going to do what you're supposed to do because you're still mad that he made you give up something. Some of you, I know you don't want to admit it, some of you are still mad that he made you give something up. Some of you are. Some of you aren't and should be because you still haven't given it up, and that's your problem. The reason some of you are saying, oh, I'm not mad about anything, that's because you haven't given it up yet. Think about it. Okay, the reason you're not mad is because you haven't given it up. There are things that you should be saying, you know what? I really liked that. I missed that. I wish I could still. And that's where you got to mourn and get over. Now, some of you have already gone through the mourning process, so now it's done. You're healed of that emotionally. Because that's what we're mostly dealing with, is emotional challenges. It's emotionally challenging for us to change. Any kind of change is emotionally challenging. Has Yahweh asked you to change at all? Have you changed anything in your life? Like, I don't know, like everything? I have had a few people call me up after listening to some of the teachings going, did we have anything right? Yes, you had some things right. But it feels like you didn't, right? I mean, it feels like you just had nothing right. We've been lied to a lot. And so let's understand, as we're looking at this covenant idea, how it fits into the Beatitudes, how it fits into James chapter 4, how it talks about our character. Because the covenant is not just with a bunch of, you know, we could have the rocks just do mechanically the Torah. It's about human beings with emotions and with feelings and with desires to take all that and subjugate it to him, direct it to him, focus it on him. That's what he's looking for. And that's the obedience. Because in the obedience, we're not just obeying. We're going to redo the love and Torah teaching soon. And when we do, you'll hear once again how love is connected to Torah observance. And what does love look like? It looks like the fruit of the Spirit. It looks like these things in the Beatitudes. It's not a mechanical thing. If you stick a child in, when they're born, in a mechanical environment, a cold, I shouldn't say cold, physically warm, and they get food and all of that, but they're not getting that human interaction, they die. They need that love. They need that human interaction. Yahweh wants human interaction for whatever reason. Well, I don't know. That was his plan. He wants human interaction. But he wants it to be loving within the context of Torah, with the fruit of the Spirit, with the Beatitudes in place. Are most of us doing that? Somewhat. I mean, I'm not going to pick on everybody. We make an effort. But can we do better? Oh, yeah, we could do better. We need to. Because we're supposed to be, you know, looking in the mirror and saying, nope, still don't see Yeshua yet. Still got a lot of me that don't look like him. And so we need to go and check ourselves to see. And what, you know, James also says, you know, don't look in that mirror and walk away and forget what you looked at. But when you're looking in the mirror, what are you looking for? Do I match what I'm looking at? When he says looking to the word as a mirror, do I look like that? He's not just talking about a glass mirror that reflects you, because he talks about the word as a mirror. Oh, here I go, back to James. Okay, so he has verse 25. Well, actually, we started in verse 23. It says, because if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror, but he looks at himself and goes away and immediately forgets what he was like. But he that looked into the perfect Torah, that of freedom, and continues in it. So see, now he's saying, comparing a man who really looks in a glass mirror, like a real mirror. But then he says, but you, if you look into the word and you compare yourself and continue to do it because you see it, you understand it, and you walk in it, and continues in it, not being a hearer that forgets, but a doer of the work, this one shall be blessed in his doing of Torah. Blessed are those who look in the mirror. We can add that to the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who look at the Torah of freedom, and continue in it, not hearers only, they shall be blessed. And that's kind of the thing that we really have a problem with. See, I know we've talked a lot about covenant, and a lot of you got excited about that. Some of you are still confused a little bit or whatever. But the bottom line is, the covenant is not just about mechanics. See, Christianity wants to convince you that all that law is a bunch of mechanical stuff, and it's dead, and it's cold, and all this other things. Most of you, hopefully, have found that it's only since you've been in Torah that you've found true life. So that's not something that's cold and just mechanical. It has life. We've talked about that. The Torah is life. The word brings life. It brings comfort. It brings peace. It brings blessing. It brings safety. And most important, it brings transformation, which is what really is what brings the life. It brings transformation. So hopefully we're starting to see here how the Beatitudes are connected to this idea of salt covenant, to the idea of covenant, which brings us back to the covenant. So when he talks about a covenant of salt, he's talking about we have a covenant with him, or should have one, that's like the ancient Near East did with the salt covenants. In other words, a covenant that was intended to play out to the end without anybody quitting, without anybody not fulfilling their obligation. Remember, all covenants, even the salt covenants, had specified performance. There was an expectation for each party to do or not do specific things. That's why it's used in wedding ceremonies. Okay, the husband's expecting certain things of the wife is expecting certain things of the husband. That's their covenant. There's specific things. Now, most people never made those vows. In sickness and health and blah, 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 nobody even remembers that stuff. Nobody knows who wrote that stuff. It's just been around forever. So when I do a wedding, we do it different. I encourage the bride and the groom to first and foremost figure out what it is that they're offering. And we're going to talk about this in the couples class tomorrow whenever I'm doing the class. But I encourage them to figure out what it is they're actually offering. What is it, if I'm marrying you, I should be able to tell you, this is what I expect from you and this is what you should expect from me. And then you should be telling me what you expect from me and what I should expect from you. And what I make a couple do is I make them negotiate that, so to speak. Write it all out, sit down, and share it. Now, after they stop laughing or yelling at each other, they can negotiate. You expect what? You're offering what? This is what you think you expect a wife to be or a husband to be? Oh, it's crazy. But I warned them before they start, that's what it's going to look like. That's okay. But then they make their vows, having already worked through all that, knowing that when, you know, how many of you have said, don't raise your hand, well, if I'd have only known... about your spouse. Well, if I'd have known she, or I'd have known he, blah, 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 blah. Well, why didn't you know? And by the way, most of that is the expectations thing. It wasn't that you didn't know something in their history or their life or something. It was because you had no idea that what they expected of you and what they expected you to accept from them. Because you looked at them like, why aren't you doing this? And the person's like, well, why would I? I never said I would do that. Oh, but, you know, my father always did that, and you know, my brothers did that, and I just expected you to do that. Or my mother did that, either way, we have expectations. See, one of the greatest things about this book that we have called the Scriptures, this word that we get from our Creator, is that He tells us exactly what He expects. And He tells us exactly what we can expect. But when you got married, you did neither of those things. You did not tell them exactly what you expected, although you probably did after you said, I do. I bet you those are fun conversations. High volume, no productivity, you know what I'm talking about? Okay. That's an old sales joke. But the thing is, you did not discuss, and set expectations. Now, here's the problem. Expectations are always being set whether you set them or not. But if you don't set them, they're probably going to be different than you desired them to be. You need to do this with your children. You need to do this with your bosses when you go and negotiate the job. I want to know what you expect of me. And I can tell you what you can expect from me. See, when I go to negotiate a job, back when I was going out and getting jobs and I wasn't doing this, I always, when I had to talk about things like Sabbath keeping, feast keeping, I would always tell them, look, I expect you to allow me to have this time off, but you can expect that I care just as much about that as the integrity of your company, as the work productivity you expect from me, as my not stealing any of your stuff, stealing of your time. I'm not going to be sitting on Facebook all day while I'm supposed to be working. See, that's the expectation thing in the discussion. My expectation is you're going to give me the time I need. Your expectation should be that I will be your best employee, that you will never need to find another one to do whatever job you gave me to do. Does that make sense? Does anybody ever do that? No. Now, if you counsel with me, you might, because I encourage people to do that. So in all relationships, especially covenanted relationships, a contract to work for an employer is a covenanted relationship. Marriages, covenanted relationships. It's always going to work better if you are clear in your expectations on both sides. And make sure that you understand, when I say both sides, meaning that when you got married, and if those of you are not, think about this before you get married. If you're looking at it from your eyes, if you're the man, you have a very clear understanding, hopefully, of what a husband looks like, at least whatever you think it might look like, and what a wife looks like and acts like and behaves like. And so does your bride-to-be. But they don't necessarily match in the pictures. And so you have to work those things through. Because you may learn something from your spouse about those things and say, you know what? We're going to have to work this out or this is going to be a very bumpy ride. Because the worst thing that happens in a marriage or in any covenant is that one of the parties or both getting disappointed and then getting disillusioned and saying, what did I get myself into? Why did I do this? Boy, was this a mistake. Some of you are struggling with that with Yahweh. You're like, you know what? I wish I took the red pill instead of the blue pill, whichever way it worked out. I forget which is which. I think it was the red pill that, you know, that took you out of the rabbit hole. That makes sense. The red's being logical. Never mind. Okay. Don't read into the two colors. But you remember that from The Matrix where the guy wanted said, man, I wish I'd ate the other pill and just stayed in the delusion because living in reality is too hard. Well, guess what? You are looking and asking and knocking and seeking, and he gave you what you wanted. But some of you are thinking it's too hard. Really? Too hard? That's why the classes I teach are called Up to the Challenge. Are you not up to the challenge of this? Because he's going to challenge you. You asked for it. You know, it's kind of like in that movie we said, you want the truth, you can't handle the truth. And all you were walking around going, I just want the truth. Until you heard it and said, well, maybe not that one. How many of you shared beware false prophets and didn't get the reaction you were hoping for? But it was the truth. But not everybody can handle that truth. That's a tough one. But the truth is that he has expectation and you have expectation. Now, you've probably grown up being pretty clear on your expectation. You expect tears wiped away, living forever, no more pain, no more suffering, all that good stuff, which, by the way, is still what he's offering. So that part's not been a problem. But you weren't really clear on what he expected of you. Why? Because you were told you didn't have to do anything because what you really needed, Yeshua did it all for you anyway. So that made it really tough. But he said, but he must expect something from me. And so we struggle. And we come to realize he's probably disappointed with me at this point. I don't know why I feel that way. I just feel that way. You start to have that feeling. Like, I don't know. My first prayer that led me to where I am today when I was in my early 20s was I noticed all these very zealously religious people in my college. They were Orthodox Jews. They were born against Christians and all the things in between. And I didn't know what to do with all that. because I had no belief system at that point. I was a secular Jew, you know, cultural Jew. And my prayer was, and some of you have heard me tell this story before, but my prayer was, Father, not Father, see, I'm so used to saying it that way. I looked up and I was like, look, if you exist, and there's something I need to be doing that I'm not, or things I need to stop doing that I'm doing, you're going to have to show me because I have no idea. And so I felt like I didn't know what was expected. Because I saw people doing different things, trying to do what they thought was expected. And the Jews and the Christians were not doing the same things. But they were doing it, claiming it was what their God expected of them. And I was thinking, okay, you guys claim to be worshiping the same God, and he expects very different things from you, apparently. I was a little confused. No surprise, right? And so this comes back to the whole covenant thing. The Beatitude starts to show you the expectations. When we started reading about it, even in James, we started looking at other things, the expectation. The expectation is that you would use the Torah as a mirror to help look and see how much you are still you and not enough him. Or how much you are now more him and less of you, and get encouraged and excited about that. Now, never does he want you to become discouraged. When you find yourself falling short, you're supposed to become motivated. There's a difference. Some of you still have the emotional challenges with your feelings everywhere, and you will more likely become discouraged before you become motivated. This is why it's awful that children today never lose. Because, oh, that would be horrible that they would suffer the emotion of losing. Listen, nobody got to be hugely successful who never lost or failed. Because it was the motivation to fix that feeling. I hate this feeling. I'm going to figure out how to make this work. That's the motivator, not the discourager. So now kids don't need to, they have no idea how to handle when they finally fail at something. Now they failed at things all the time, but nobody ever told them they failed. Nobody ever told them they lost. Nobody ever told them how bad it felt to have a, you know, what they call, like that rule they have when you're playing in sports and it's like so many nothing and they just say, forget it, you lose. Because it's like, we don't want you to suffer more, you're already getting killed. It's like a mercy rule, right? That mercy rule. Well, it's already 23-0, I think we'll just call it, you know? Because clearly you guys are just miserable. But you know what? That team can get really motivated. But you don't get motivated from never losing. And so that's part of what we read on Sabbath when it said, look, you know, and if you don't learn, I'm going to punish you. Now, when you get punished, you could get discouraged or you could get motivated. And he wants us not to get discouraged. So I wanted to make sure as I'm saying all this, some of you are thinking, I'm never going to make it because I keep messing up. I'm never going to get this. Stop that. Let me just knock it off. Stop it. Okay? We don't go there. Some of you know the Bob Newhart routine. Okay, look it up. Bob Newhart, stop it. That'll just make your day. Complete counseling in 5 minutes. But you got to stop it. You got to stop going there. The covenant is something you and you, all of you, can do. You can do this. I'm going to be the encouraging motivator now. You can do this. But you can only do this if you can get you out of the way. Let me rephrase that. You can't do this. You getting yourself under complete control and then choosing to get out of the way, that one of you can do this. Oh, but I can't do that part. Yes, you can. He would never give you something. He says, I won't give you anything that you can't do. I'm not going to give you something you can't do. Doesn't he say that? Well, you're here. Guess what that means? You can do it. I don't know what else to say, but you can do it. Okay, I'm going to say something a little different. I think I've said this once or twice, but different than what I've said a million times, which is, you know, you need to get off the throne, etc. Well, you know what? You need to get on the throne first. You need to get fully in control of yourself and then get off the throne because you're letting others sit on that throne, letting your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your boss, your cousin, your best friend all sit on that throne. So it's not just like when I say, you need to get off it. Some of you are like, well, I'm not even on it. Well, kick whoever's on it off of there. And then say, Yeshua, here's your throne. Okay? I mean, come on. Get control over your self-sovereignty, and then you choose voluntarily to submit that sovereignty to him. Turn that over to him. Problem is, you got all kinds of people taking over and sitting in that throne. You probably feel like Egypt every other year was taken over by a different country, or Israel. I mean, right? They had all these countries coming back and forth and taking them over and attacking and everything else. Don't let other people and other, you know, friends, family, whatever, don't let them sit on that throne. Oh, other teachers. Some of you will come to me. Well, you know, I know all of this stuff here and what it says, but you know, I watched this teaching. And now I'm all confused. Oh, goodness. That doesn't mean that everything I say is right and perfect. But if you're starting to hear something different than the person you chose as your teacher, before you get confused, as soon as it sounds different, go to that teacher and say, this was what's going on. Now, some of you are still going down paths. I mean, I've got some of you sending me teachings that are still mainstream Christian teachings. So why are we even listening to that? Oh, but they're great. They're what? I got people sending me prophetic stuff, end time stuff, and all kinds of stuff out of mainstream Christian teaching still. I just don't even know what to say if you're still listening to that. I don't know what I'm going to tell you. If you haven't figured out that you need to not be messing with that anymore, you're still way at that early babe stage. You've got to figure this thing out. Where you were got you to where you were. If you don't want to be where you were, you got to stop doing all the stuff and receiving from where you were. You can't keep halfway attached and like your leg or your half your body is over in this other thing. You have to disconnect from all that. Become a blank slate. Become teachable and instructable in new things so that you can understand what he really has for you. Amen? Because otherwise, we're just not getting anywhere. Let's look at Mark chapter 9. I just realized at some point I should get back to the verses here, so. Mark chapter 9. I'm just got in a preachy mood for a minute. What can I do? Mark 9 and verse 43. And if one hand makes you stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life crippled than having two hands to go into Gehenna, into the unquenchable fire, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your foot makes you stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life crippled than having two feet to be thrown into Gehenna, into the unquenchable fire, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your eye makes you stumble, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter into the reign of the heaven, reign of Elohim, with one eye, than having two eyes to be thrown into the fire of Gehenna, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. For everyone shall be seasoned with fire, and every offering shall be seasoned with salt. Now, the word seasoned is actually not in the Greek there, but it says, for everyone shall be with fire, and every offering shall be with salt. Salt is good, but if the salt becomes tasteless, how shall you season it? Have salt in yourselves to be at peace among one another, and be at peace among one another. Now, unfortunately, some of you heard only a piece of what I said because you were so distracted by, oh, end time stuff, the worm doesn't die, the fire is unquenchable, and you got all distracted. You got all distracted. And now that I'm telling you I'm not going to cover that, you almost sound like the baby leaving the room. You're going to be like, well, I want him to cover that. Okay? This is really the problem, is that you have to understand stumbling as connected to salt. If what you're doing with your hands is causing you to stumble, then better you shouldn't have a hand. If what you're seeing is causing, what you're looking at, what you focus on is causing you to stumble, better you shouldn't have an eye. If your walk is causing you to stumble because of where you tend to go and what you tend to do, better you shouldn't be walking. That's what it's saying here. Let's not worry about the unquenchable fire and what it means the worm doesn't die and all that other stuff. You don't need to understand that. You need to understand the part he wants you to understand, which is about the hand and the foot and the eye and the stumbling and how it connects to salt. And what is salt connected to? Covenant. He's saying if you're covenanted, don't let what his hands always talking about, the work of your hands, what the things that you do, don't let that cause you a stumbling. better you should not be doing it. So what is that talking about? There are things that you do that in themselves may not be a problem, just in itself. But in doing it, you're exposed to the opportunity to do something that's stumbling. People you hang out with, places you go, things that you do can cause you to stumble, even though in itself it might not have been a problem. Actually, some of those things may be a problem for you and not for you. Each person may have their own thing. So one of you may be able to go do or say or watch or look at and not have any problem. Some of you will have a huge problem because of it. And so that's really what it comes down to. Okay? And so, but it's the eyes. Hey, the lust of the eyes, the things that we see and what we go after, the hands, the things that we do and that kind of thing, the feet, where we go, how we walk. It said, better you shouldn't have any of those things going on. Now, it doesn't say that you should be lame and just sitting there doing nothing. It's a metaphor. Be careful of the things that you're doing and where you're going and what you're looking at, because they could cause you to stumble. And if they cause you to stumble, then it talks about how it's connected to what? Salt. To covenant. And he also says that everyone shall be with fire. What does the fire do? It's going to test to see if the hand, the foot, the eye, and these things are being a problem. So that means that you might find yourself tempted when you're doing the things you're doing, or walking the walk you're doing, or the eyes, the things that you're looking at, etc. And there'll be a fire to test. And so here you go through this whole process here. But he says, look, salt is good, but it's only good unless it becomes tasteless. He says, but then how shall you season with it? Have salt in yourselves. Have salt in yourselves. Have a commitment to covenant in yourselves and be at peace among one another. So now he's also connecting it to shalom. If you're letting your hands cause you problems, and if you're letting your eyes cause you problems, you're letting your feet cause you problems, you're not going to have shalom. You're not going to have peace. Why won't you have peace? I don't know. I just thought I'd ask you. No, I'm kidding. You're looking at me like, what? But why wouldn't you have peace? Because you will be double-minded. And it talked about not being double-minded in James 4. Because you want what you're doing. You want what you're seeing. You want where you're going. And you realize you shouldn't be. Now you're not at peace because you're double-minded. You're of two minds. You're recognizing where you shouldn't be, but you're also recognizing that you want to be. I want to go, but I know I shouldn't. I want to do, but I know I shouldn't. I want to look at or whatever, but I know I shouldn't. So now how do we deal with that? Now we're unstable. And being unstable, we could stumble. And that stumbling could be a real problem for our salt, losing its taste. In other words, the covenant starts to be broken. It loses its relational part. Because it's not just a cold document. It's a relationship. The covenant is the wording of the relationship. It describes the relationship. Now, it's a lot more than the simplicity of Exodus 19. You know, you just do what I say, and I'll take you to my people. Because he goes on later to say, and you shall love me with all your heart, might, and being. And you shall do these things. You shall speak of these things when you lie down, and when you rise up, and when you walk by the way, etc. And when you're binding them as a sign. All of the stuff that's in the Vahafta. Deuteronomy 6, 5 through 9, and it talks about that relationship. And all the scriptures dealing with that relationship. And Yeshua came to show them the Father and talk about that relationship. And he says, look at me. This is what it looks like when you do everything the Father says to do. This is what it looks like. This is the result of doing everything the Father says to do. Because I only do what the Father says to do. That's what he said. And so here we have this additional section here of showing, oh, the stumbling, there's a connection here to salt, which is a connection to covenant, which is a connection to how we see things and how we do things and how our walk is going. When I say see things, I'm not just talking about like looking at pornography or some. I mean, how you just see life, how you see people, how you see anything. It's the eyes have to do with how we see things. Because some of you think, well, I don't have any problem with lust and that kind of stuff, so he's not talking about me. No, the eye here is not listed as specific to anything else. If your eye makes you stumble, you see something and it causes you to stumble. Some of you have seen a brother or a sister do something and it caused you to stumble because you couldn't handle what you saw them do. So it's what you see, how you handle things, literally like with your hands, and where you go, how you walk. This is what we're talking about. Let's go before the Father. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. Father, we come before you as we are working towards understanding covenant more and more. We're seeing now that there's a huge part of this that has to do with being salt and understanding the flavor and the savor of salt and its connection to the Beatitudes, its connection to letting go of things and getting over them and humbling ourselves so that you can lift us up. It has to do with not allowing ourselves to stumble by action, by our walk, by our, what we see. Father, we come to you knowing how hard this is for us, but accepting that rather than be discouraged, we're now looking to be motivated. We want to become like Yeshua. We want to hear those words, well done, good and trustworthy servant. We want to be welcomed into the kingdom. We want to be well-pleasing in your sight, all these things that you say in your word. And Father, we struggle. And we're so glad that your word will continue to give us encouragement on how to overcome these things in the struggle that we struggle. And so, Father, we thank you. We ask for your mercy and your compassion as we walk this out, knowing that day after day we stumble, but also little by little we have victory as we become that little bit more like Yeshua. So, Father, we praise you, giving you all glory and honor. In the name above all names, Yeshua our Messiah. Amen. The Amen.